We're back, everybody. I am mining investor and editor of Resource Stock Digest, Gerardo Del Real, here with my partner, Mr. Nick Hodge, who's also an investor, of course, and the publisher of Bizarro World. This is the 372nd episode of our weekly therapy session that we call Investing in Bizarro World. We're going to talk markets. We're going to talk gold, silver, copper, ice, Israel, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, rates, you name it. A lot to get to. We were gone for a week. It feels great to be back. A lot of you joining us for the first time this week after meeting several of you at the very busy Rural Symposium last week. We'll get to all of that, but welcome to our new subscribers and watchers. And Mr. Hodge, how goes you this fine Thursday?
Doing good, Gerardo. Glad to be back. Better than the markets in some respects, which I'm sure we'll talk about. A lot of news out there, a lot of back and forth on many things. That's why it's a bizarro world. It was good, as you said, to be at the Rural Symposium, to see you, to see Tim, who's behind the camera slash app, to see some other folks, Jimmy, who's our customer service guy, subscribers, many of which came up to us and said hi. So thank you for that. New ones, because we had a booth there and met a lot of new people as well. And then catching up with companies, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well, many of which are on either Resource Stock Digest or in my portfolio or your portfolio. And it's sunny and 95 degrees. Can't complain. Pool's open. Middle of summer. How are you?
Wife still loves me. It's nice and hot outside. The pool is open. Couldn't be more thankful. The kids are healthy. All of them are doing amazing things to get into the next phase of their life, whether it's, you know, my oldest, who's in China right now for work, to the middle one, who's in Alaska, you know, taking care of things out there, to our youngest, which just had his braces taken off, our 17-year-old, and is on his way to Portland next month for school. So a lot of change, a lot of progress. And I think, you know, to that note, I want to start with the Rural Symposium. We were there for a full week. Phenomenal conference, a long conference, but it was top-notch exhibitors, top-notch presenters, including yourself, obviously, Nick. But the quality of the attendees, I was surprised how well-versed and how nuanced the attendees were. I mean, I had full half-hour conversations with people, many full half-hour conversations with people, and it was fantastic to hear them asking the right questions. We held a brunch on the last day on Friday, and despite it being the last day of a five-day conference, I think there were some, it was a sold-out brunch. We had something like 80 people there to listen to you and myself speak. Jeff Phillips, friend and mentor, was kind enough to introduce us. And that went extremely well. So I'd love to hear your take. I mean, I'll give you mine as far as sentiment and all that goes here in a bit. But I wanted to compliment the attendees. And again, I think several of you are probably listening now because we've seen you subscribe here over the past week. So welcome. And hopefully we give you your money's worth here on the market side of things. And hopefully we don't offend too much on the societal side of things, because it is a bizarro world, folks.
Yeah, you and I have covered it in our issues, which have gone out to the weekly issues for paying folks in either Junior Resource Speculator or Underground Alpha. but, you know, the sentiment in the resource space, and not just the sentiment, but the prices have been subdued at the least. We can talk about it when we get more into the macro portion of this podcast. But there was a lot of ruralisms that were thrown around there. One guy was even handing out stickers. I don't know if you met that guy. He had stickers made up of some of Rick Rule's best sayings, like
I missed
price, delta, value, and got a hunch, buy a bunch. He was like handing out the stickers. It was amazing. But there obviously is a disconnect between price and value in many sectors of the resource market right now. And that was one of the main themes that Rick was talking about. He foresees significant consolidation, i.e. mergers and acquisitions. I believe the phrase was an orgy of
amalgamation.
An orgy of amalgamation. He can come up with some good ones. And then all the red meat too, you know, which is typical, like the Fed and the money printing and structural deficits. And I was writing about some of that stuff in Foundational Profits. But the fundamentals are one thing, whether it's uranium or copper or gold and silver, but the price is something else. And then on the equities, the prices are soft as well. So I guess I'm boiling it down to one theme, and the theme for me was, you know, find the value, irrespective or regardless of the price, because babies are getting thrown out with bathwater. And, you know, there's a big educational component as well. Rick has his rural classroom, and he's, you know, he tells the attendees to train up, educate themselves, take notes, watch the recordings, and he's instructed them or trained them to ask the right questions. And I would echo what you said about the quality of the attendees. I mean, there's real deep money there that is not in or had been made in the resource space.
Yep.
You know, lots of high net worth individuals, either from high salary or high earning jobs, doctors and pilots and that sort of stuff. And then a lot of real estate folks as well that were serially successful in whatever, property development or multifamily housing or whatever. So, and they're looking to deploy space in, or deploy money into the space in a meaningful way. So I guess the last thing I'll say is what I was speaking about, because I knew there would be a lot of why there, which I just sort of covered, like the, you know, we all know why we want to invest in gold, the debts and the obligations or the unfunded liabilities, as Rick would say. So I talked about the how, and that's what your lunch talk was about as well. And that was basically private placements, which we talked to many folks about, and how to get in early in these companies' life cycles at low valuations, with sometimes either discounts to the price at which they're trading, or before anyone else can buy them, like IPOs or during a merger or an RTO or something like that, plus the leverage that comes with the warrants. So I hope to make that talk available. I haven't got the recording yet, but hopefully in the next week or so we can get that up somewhere, maybe on the Bizarre World YouTube channel or something like that. And then you, I'm sorry to ramble on, but you were very busy as well, wearing multiple hats on the Resource Doc Digest side with plenty of interviews. So what were your takeaways?
Yeah. Takeaway number one, as I explained, the quality of the attendees. Takeaway number two is I'm going to echo the same sentiment on the amount of intelligent capital that I think is going to be deployed here over the summer. Which, look, for folks that are there's two types of people that are new to the space. There's those that came in January that were excited about all the news stories about gold going to 10,000, which will still happen likely because of the debt. Uranium going to triple digits, excuse me, which will still happen. Copper going to $8, $9, $10, which will still happen. All of that. But the main driver of the new capital in January was new all-time highs in gold, $5,500. Everybody was excited. Big, that 5,000 number was a big psychological factor for people. It brought in a lot of capital. And what's happened since is most companies that you bought are probably down some 60% since the January highs. Worth noting, if you look back and you just look at the forest and you look at it from a one-year perspective, gold is a lot higher today, sitting at $39.74 than it was a year ago. Silver, after this pullback, that's scaring the bejeebies, which contrarian me loves because it signals a likely near bottom or a bottom, sitting at 55. It was in the 30s a year ago, folks. So context is important. That doesn't feel good when you look at your portfolio if you were comparing it to the January highs. If you are new to this space, coming in with capital, and or if you have capital that you're looking to deploy to average down on your entry point, you're absolutely right, Nick. The question you should be asking is, what are these companies doing to add value? And what is the real value that is there? Not the share price, not the market cap. The market cap and the share price are important relative to the value that these companies are either adding or providing. In the premium portion of this podcast, we'll get into companies that have assays pending, drills turning, they raised money during the highs of January, they're cashed up for the next year or two. And so with those companies that are large holdings of mine, personal holdings and our group holdings, sure, some of the share prices are down, you know, 50-60% from their all-time highs. Sit back and let these companies execute, let them add value, let them prove up discoveries, let them add to what they've already discovered. The market will catch up when the market catches up. The only time that doesn't work, folks, is if you are in a bear market or a declining market as it relates to the commodity space. Gold is in a bull market, make no mistake. This is a consolidation that's healthy. Silver, bull market, make no mistake. This is a consolidation. Ditto for uranium, ditto for lithium. The lithium equities are an absolute gift right now. You have companies that, you know, have pulled back some 35% over the last month. price of lithium year to date is still up 35%, folks. Like, people, it's cooled because consolidations are important and healthy. Things don't go straight up, but a lot of the juniors especially are ridiculously oversold. If you are new to this space, welcome aboard, and you're going to feel real smart, I think, by the end of the year. I've made that mistake before of mistaking brains for a bull market for brains. So I caution that when you deploy capital this summer and you're buying stuff likely near the lows of the year, and by year end, you've doubled and tripled your money, knock on wood, trim a little bit, thank the lucky stars, but know that you're in a bull market that forgives consolidations and that turns around rather quickly. Being down 50 to 60%. Is the absolute norm in this space. All of my 100%, 500%, 1,000%, 10,000% wins at one point were down some 50 or 60%. So knowing what the catalysts are that are going to create value, that's more important to me than the actual share price today. And again, I would much rather see my portfolio at all-time highs, but it's going to be a fun exercise between now and year end, because I think the second half of this year, the last two quarters, we're going to have phenomenal quarters in the commodity space. The one asterisk being, of course, the instability geopolitically that none of us can control. Mathematically, I don't think that this war can continue on for more than another 4 to 6 weeks. We'll see. We don't exactly have like the most logical people in charge on either side. Some we don't even know if they're alive, like Mitch McConnell, right? I mean, there was a guy that was missing for a couple of months. And just didn't vote or do anything, but he drew a salary. And then he came out like 2 weeks ago and he said, I had some mental health issues that I had to step away from. It'd be really nice if in the real world, people got to step away for a couple of months and still got paid and still got health insurance and still got Secret Service protection. But those people don't live in the real world, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, folks. So don't let me get on my rant early on in this thing. We're in a bull market, folks. It's going to be a fun last two quarters of the year. Consider yourself fortunate that whether you got here in January or you've been here for the last 2 or 3 years, which means you're up, or if you're brand new and just about to start allocating capital, timing couldn't be better. We got a bull market in our hands.
He's working on a movie, Weekend at Mitch's. last thing on Rule, and then I'll move on to the macro section, is he said exactly what you just said. You know, he had hired an intern at one point to do back testing of his portfolio. And it turns out that his largest wins were in fact down some 50% or more before they turned out to be his largest wins. So volatility inherent in the space, as you said, it doesn't feel good, especially if you came into the space in January. What I was writing about for Foundational Profits this month, which will be out tomorrow, is, you know, the beatings will continue until the macro improves. Like, the fundamentals really don't matter, whether that's emerging structural deficits in copper and uranium or whatever, central bank buying and gold, like none of that stuff matters. All that's mattered since the last weekend in February when the bombs started dropping is the macro inputs, basically the dollar and yield, specifically the U.S. 10-year yield. So if I look at the numbers, which I'm doing right now, and I'll give you a little taste of one of the sections of that issue, is, you know, the U.S. 10-year yield is up 15% since we started buying, or since we started bombing Iran. The dollar has gone up nearly 5% and is consolidating right around 100. There's been some mixed signals. Like, in the past couple of days, the dollar has softened just a little bit. I'm not sure if it's ready to break trend or not. And the U.S. 2-year yield has started going the other way. Indicative of falling inflation, which I saw you had on the list. And that was because, you know, oil prices came down so precipitously once we reached the ceasefire. Problem with that is, the ceasefire
is not anymore.
And oil's back on the rise. So, the Fed probabilities have been sort of all over the place. It's basically stalemate. Like, they're not going to do anything, which could be good, and we'll see what the inflation wild card does. But at the end of the day, the 10-year yield has not come down, and that's given or played hell with these commodity prices. Like, gold is down 25%. Call it a correction, and in most markets, 20 plus percent downside is a crash.
Silver down 50.
I was getting there. I was going to go down the list. So silver's down more than 50% since its all-time high. It was $116 in late January, and it's less than half that now, obviously down some 50-some percent. And gold, which we've been telling you is, for lack of a better term, sort of like the dollar, the cleanest dirty shirt in the commodity basket right now, is, you know, it had corrected, which is the proper term for a 10% drawdown, and it's held up better. But if you look at the major ETF, like the most popular copper miner ETF, COPEX, it's still down some 20% since March, right? So until the dollar rolls over, until the Fed either turns dovish or inflation starts coming down and bond yields turn around, I think that it's going to be a tough row to hoe for these commodity and precious metals prices. And that just is what it is. Like, you can't control the macro markets. You can't control the erratic president and the geopolitics and things like that. We can just do as you say and identify the companies that are delivering that value, or fortunately in our case, having been pre-positioned at much lower prices, right, where we can just bide our time and wait. I guess that's it on the macro side of the metals. A little personal chest pounding. I was putting together the issue and in doing the allocation, you know, we were sitting on some 30 some percent cash still. We had taken some profits off the table back in October, again in April, and then sold one or two of our commodity positions in June, as it was pretty clear that the macro trend was not in our friend. That doesn't mean that we're not still heavily weighted to GLD and GDXJ, but it is to say that, you know, we've lightened up positions and we've taken some cash on the table, and other things are working. So if you indulge me for another 90 seconds, you know, the S&P is still at near all-time highs. It's just being driven by other things. We had rotation on the docket 2 weeks ago when we had a podcast, and that's exactly what you're seeing. Like, if you look at the S&P sectors for the year, it's IT and energy, because oil prices went up so high in the first half of the year. But if you look at just the past month, there's a rotation on to financials are now leading, which could be because rates are about to come down. We'll see. Industrials are up there. Utilities are up there. And so there's a broadening of the bull market. So that was interesting to me. Still long on the S&P side of things. Again, it's near all-time highs. And so there are things to own out there outside of just the resource space that are delivering returns. And that's another thing you can do in sort of, you know, quiet periods like this, let's call it.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Technical levels for those that are, you know, have a psychological bias that see a breakdown below 4,000 on the gold price and think, how are we looking, Nick? I know before we had discussed support, yep. I believe at the 3915 level, if I recall correctly, but you're the technician amongst the two of us. How are we looking with gold and where's the support at?
You're near support. Gold is like 3930. If that breaks, it's going down closer to, I don't know, 3,300, 3,400, something like that. You're getting there now. You read the gold price earlier in this podcast. It's below 4,000. Silver is sort of similar, $54 or so, needs to hold in the near term. So you're at the bottom end of those trading ranges, let's call it. And we'll see if they bounce around, which is what they've been doing. Like the last time gold was here a couple of weeks ago or early July, like it bounced off that high $3,900 level. So we'll see. But again, back to the rates and the dollar, until you see sort of those go the other way, it's going to be tough for these precious metals and commodities to get back to bullish. The copper looks the best, obviously. You know, it's right around $6 is near-term support, just a little bit above that. So still a healthy price for copper, although it is down off the highs just a little bit. And you mentioned lithium. I was looking at that chart earlier. You know, a hell of a start to the year. Got up to almost $30,000 per ton of lithium carbonate at the end of May or the mid of May, but that's come down as well to something like, I don't know, nearly $22,000. Yeah, exactly right. So definitely some softness out there. And I won't beat that dead horse. So commodity prices, tough road to hoe with the macro picture out there.
Yeah. And again, midterm, long-term, absolutely bullish. short term, like the next several weeks or the next month or two. A lot of it's going to depend on what happens geopolitically. And so definitely something to watch.
And you'll get a Fed meeting on the 30th. So really interested to see what Mr. Wash Your Hands has to say.
Yeah. And look, I'll note the gurus in the space, if you want to call them that, the Jeff Currys of the world, you know, they've gone long again after he was short-term bearish. He had said when it was 4,500, it's going to go to 4,000 before it goes to 10,000, dropped just below 4,000. And he came out 2 days ago and said, I'm back long. I'm in the market buying. China in the market buying. Martin Armstrong, for better or worse, right? He's a polarizing guy. I've been following him for a while. I like a lot of his writing. I disagree with, you know, like everybody, some of his opinions on things, as many people disagree with a lot of my opinions on things, part of the course, but I respect what he does. And look, he said that, you know, he believes that gold has put in a low and is headed much, much higher here in August. So, and to close out the year. So bull market is absolutely intact. All of this can change by the time we're here next week doing this podcast once again because of the nature of the bizarro world that we are in right now. So look, those are your technicals for gold, for silver. Copper's looking good. The equities, again, like you mentioned, especially the juniors getting thrown out with the bathwater, right? That's just the case right now. It's summertime. Look for value. Look for companies that are adding value, that are initiating catalysts. I don't like it when the markets get soft and all of a sudden companies go quiet and they're no longer reporting to the market and shareholders what they're doing to add value. Your job is to create value. The markets are going to do what the markets are going to do. We've made a lot of money in bear markets. We've made money in bull markets. We've lost money in bear markets and we've lost money in bull markets. The trick is adding value. So companies are out there listening. I expect you to be working over the summer, not just hanging out at the beach or hanging out in the pool. I want to see news releases or your stock will get sold. So with that, yeah, go ahead, Nick.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, that was another takeaway from the conference. Like the companies, the CEOs are excited. Like you said, lots of folks raised money over the past year because it was euphoric in the commodities and precious metal space. So companies have a lot to talk about. They have capital to deploy. I know you had summer exploration on the list there. Yeah, there's plenty of active drill programs. People optioning properties, people drilling properties, lots of good work being done. So that was one of the upsides. And then, you know, back to the price and the value, you can see some capitulation out there.
Oh, yeah.
Like we were talking about it yesterday. We'll talk about it later. But I mean, just big wide daily candles on some of these names. And you look, and sometimes it doesn't even last for long. Like just a hypothetical example, you'll see a stock that has been trading at, you know, 20 to 30 cents and look, and it's at 12 cents for a couple of hours or a couple of trades, and then it's back up to 18 or 20 cents. So I don't know if that's throw it in the towel or algorithmic manipulation because of the softness we're seeing in the space, but you're definitely seeing some, I don't know if it's bottom sentiment, but it's certainly capitulation in some of these names that you can, you know, have good value in adding or in initiating if you're new to the space or, you know, if you're comfortable because you've been watching these names for a while.
Well said. Let's talk about capitulation. Some Democrats and all the Republicans have completely capitulated to Israel. With the exception, one exception, Mr. Thomas Massie, credit where credit is due. He's been consistent. He just, you know, decided that he's going to float out an amendment to strip Section 219, which combines the U.S. military along with the Israeli military and gives them full access to our technology, our databases, our military in essence. And so, again, let me be absolutely clear. I am all for alliances. I am all for working together with allies and governments and militaries around the world that are friendly to us and that can provide aid, whether it's technologically, whether it's economically, whatever the case may be. I am completely dead set against us merging our military with anyone. The founding fathers of this country would be rolling over. The Democrats who have never, I shouldn't say never, who have of recent time, I mean like the last decade, have yet to find a spine, right? Despite all of the unpopular decisions with the war and the corruption. We'll talk more about that in the Trump administration here in a little bit. Despite all of the stuff that the right is doing to alienate itself from most of middle America, whether on the right or on the left, the Democrats still can't raise any money and come up with a single good idea, right? They still want to fight over identity issues and culture
social
politics.
Social issues,
and, yeah. Yeah, all of that. And I don't know. I don't know who the heck they have consulting on their end, but they need their heads checked. On this, they actually all voted against not only combining the military, but they voted against funding to the tune of $3 trillion the Israeli military, which, again, refuses to put troops on the ground for a war that they're having us fight on their behalf, for a war that they continue to sabotage any kind of forward progress on. So whether it's Mexico, France, Spain, Argentina, or Israel, I'm not for merging our military with any other government, permanently or temporarily. It is the one last institution that, despite us not being able to fund it in an ethical and honest way, because we're just printing the money at this point and running up the debt, it is the one institution that currently allows us to still be the world superpower, because economically that's declining. Educationally, that's declining. When it comes to checks and balances, that's declining, and it's declining on both sides of the aisle, right? So glad to see the Democrats find a spine on an issue, see if they do anything with it. But look, I Rand Paul voted for this. Rand Paul. I mean, this is, again, someone I've given a lot of credit for on the Epstein files and a lot of other issues. He's been he's had several really, really intelligently thought out bills on fiscal policy and how to reduce the budget, how to pay for our stuff moving forward in an ethical and honest way, so future generations, you know, don't get more of the tab sent to them. And on this, again, complete capitulation. So disappointing. I don't know if it's surprising. I think it's part of that fourth turning, Nick, that you and I talk about, where people are just so compromised that they're having to show their hand, right? Lindsey Graham died unexpectedly and suddenly. War hawk Lindsey Graham, right? And he was as big a proponent for this war as anyone. And the first thing they did was they sent the FBI to go make sure all the blackmail material was out of his house, right? And that's the only thing that you can think of why the FBI would be all over his house, right? So, no, look, it's a fourth turning for sure. I think we're getting to see everyone's cards. We're getting to see who is blocking the release of the Epstein files. There was really powerful victim testimony by one of the victims where she called out Todd Blanche, who, by the way, was Trump's personal attorney before being, you know, the law of the land that gets to decide on Epstein. He's a guy that kept the files before from really getting out there. But, you know, there was this woman who came out who was a victim of that heinous, you know, time in Florida and on the island. And she said, look, the first time that he leaked my nude picture in my name, I thought maybe it was an accident. Then he did it a second time. And by the third time he did it, I knew for a fact it wasn't an accident. It was intentional and it was meant to keep us quiet, because they did a brilliant job of redacting the perpetrators and the offenders of these just nasty, nasty, nasty acts. And so nasty stuff all the way around, man, from the capitulation of some of our biggest institutions to the covering up of pedophilia, rape, and by their own admission, the torture and death videos of children. That's where we're at in 2026. For those of you that are new to the podcast, this is the second half. We do a little bit of this almost every week, and then it gets back to the markets here in the premium portion of the podcast. But it's been a couple of weeks. Had to get that off my back because, man, just ugly stuff out there.
Well, I told you a couple of weeks ago that the Kathy Rumler, who was, you know, is still you know, the lead attorney at Goldman Sachs and was heavily involved in the files that were released and the emails, not only was asked not to resign by Goldman Sachs, but was back in the news this week saying that those emails were taken out of context and misunderstood. So maybe you have it wrong, Gerardo. What's next on the Israel vote, since the Democrats for the most part voted against it? I'm also interested to see see how Fetterman voted. I'll have to look that up. But like, what's next in the process?
You know how Fetterman voted. So next in the process is Massey.
He voted with the Republic. He voted with the Republicans.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I think he threatened to leave the Democratic Party because of not just the vote against the blending of the two militaries, the merging of the two militaries and their capabilities in intelligence and technology. But also he was really upset that people voted against the $3 trillion funding package, right? And so, look, Netanyahu himself, who, by the way, isn't popular, very popular with his own people. Two-thirds of the people in Israel don't want him in office. There's a reason why he needs this war to continue. It's what keeps him kind of going and floating. He's got an election coming up in October, if I'm not mistaken. So that kind of coincides with our midterms. And it's why we have this push-pull thing where we have a ceasefire. We no longer have a ceasefire. We have a ceasefire. We no longer have a ceasefire. Again, it speaks to, I think, the nature of how compromised a lot of our politicians are on this side of the aisle, that every time they try to do something logical, you know, I think they get the folder sent to them and they get reminded of what can happen before the midterms. And so, so the other thing that happened was, you know, there was a large block of especially Democrats that said, look, if Netanyahu's out here telling everyone he doesn't need our funding, that they can be independent, let them be independent. Let them seek their own funding. I mean, again, President Trump ran on a platform I mostly agreed with. No more foreign wars. Let's cut the federal deficit down. DOGE is going to cut down on the corruption, the waste, and the fat of a bloated government. We're going to have the best economy ever. We're going to bring jobs back to America. Like, all of these are things that I was fully for. Him and I didn't get on immigration because he never put forth a comprehensive immigration plan. And now we're seeing the consequence of just letting cowboys go become ICE agents with people continually getting murdered, shot, arrested, oftentimes without reason. In the most recent case in Maine, the gentleman had a social security number, was in the country legally to work. He had work authority. He had his kid with him in PJs. They shot this guy through the front windshield, I don't know how many times, and then dragged him out of his car and threw him on the floor like a piece of meat and handcuffed him in front of his kid while his daughter screamed. Like, and then they want to look at the American public, and you got flock cameras all over the place, right? That can like detail every little movement of you from the time that you get up to the time you go get your coffee, to the time you go to the gym, to when you go back home, to when you go back to the store, when you come back to make dinner. Like, they can triangulate everything at any given time. And we'll have that discussion another day. But you're telling me that every single time something happens, whether it's Charlie Kirk, which we now know they don't have a video of the shooting all of a sudden, this killing in Maine. Oh, they didn't have body cameras. But then there were pictures that were leaked of them actually having body cameras. And they said, oh, well, the body cameras went off. The Epstein thing, same thing. Oh, the cameras. And then they tried to sell us the grainy videos, and they tried to stitch together videos, but they forgot a minute. Oops. And then they said, okay. Like, I mean, it's just insane, the stuff that's going on out here. It's completely, completely bizarre world. And I don't even know where to start with these rants anymore. There's just so much that goes on. That to me is not isolated. It's very intentional. It's policy. And it's meant, I think, to overwhelm the average American into thinking that the best thing to do is just sit back because government is your friend. And I'm here to tell you that historically, the way our country was founded is by acknowledging and realizing that government is not your friend. And that's why there are checks and balances. That's why the founding fathers put those in place. And every day I see, you know, the dilution of those checks and those balances. And I look forward to a day where that turns. I hope I'm around for it.
You covered a lot of ground there. I was looking something up for 1 second, and you already ran through the ice and the flock cameras. I mean, yeah, back to the founding fathers. You know, I was looking up George Washington's farewell address, where he specifically warned against foreign entanglements, and he advised the United States to steer clear of permanent alliances. Sound familiar? Arguing that political and military ties with foreign powers would compromise the nation's independence and drag it into unnecessary wars. And then the ICE stuff, I haven't even had time to read up on it. I just catch the headlines and it's like, oh, they killed somebody else. Oh, in Houston. Oh, they killed somebody else in Maine. And it's like, well, I don't even know. It's just egregious, right? I mean, at this point, you read about, you know, people being mistreated once they're arrested, or just the violent nature of these ICE policemen. And that's, you know, un-American, right? That goes against, like, I don't want to say the Constitution, but it goes against, like, how we should be policing and the ethics that we should have as a nation and as an institution of our government, right? Where these folks are clearly trigger happy. They're content, and the courts are content to let them cover their faces. And it's just getting ridiculous out there. And it's been going on now for, I mean, over half a year. You and I were together in January at a conference when we had the shooting in Minnesota. And
yep.
After the recent Supreme Court rulings about birthright citizenship, which you and I also talked about, and there was some checks and balances there. But clearly the administration, the Trump administration, wasn't happy with those rulings and has ramped up those enforcements, if that's the word you have to use. But really the intimidation, I would say, tactics of immigration enforcement, right? And so, I mean, extrajudicial killings, whether it's in the Caribbean, bombing these boats which I'm pretty sure we've killed like over 200 people now. That's like mm-hmm. quietly gone under the rug. Mm-hmm. It's like not the American way, despite, you know, many folks, including myself on some of these issues, you know, agreeing with the underlying cause.
Yes.
Like, yes, I don't agree that you should be, you know, drug running into the United States, but no. I also don't agree that we should be killing people without evidence and without, you know, some sort of investigation and fair trial. That's sort of what makes America America. And that has been slipping for a long time. I mean, you mentioned the fourth turning already, but, you know, and we talk ad nauseum about, you know, Citizens United and when things started to change. All the way back to like and you talked about flock cameras, you know, I mean, this is nothing new since, you know, Edward Snowden told us that the NSA is spying on everybody, right? Like, and it just has continued to go on and has metastasized. And there's been no, as you said, checks or balances in terms of that stuff, to the point now where seemingly the Justice Department and the CIA and the FBI are rogue and doing the bidding of the president, which is certainly not how this country was set up. So no matter what side you're on, and I'm on neither, definitely an independent sort of libertarian minded guy. If you believe in America, if you believe in American ideals and the Constitution, like where we're at now isn't where we should be, right? And I don't know what's going to get us back to that point, given that you know, there's no way the U.S. is going to, citizens can take on the government at this point. And might have had some romanticism or some fantasies about that in my younger days. But, you know, there ain't no militia coming to take on like these flock cameras and drones and things like that. So going to have to correct itself at the ballot box and by getting some people in office who have their head on straight or have a spine, like you said. And I still don't see that. And I'll give you a moment of levity. There was a little Spokane anecdote here to make you smile. We have a lot of coffee shops here. It's the Pacific Northwest, and they have marquee signs out front. And one of the owners of a coffee shop this week put on their marquee sign, trans men or women. Or no, trans women or men. Sorry, I said it backwards. And do you know that... I also have covered recently that we elected a self-proclaimed socialist to the city council. She called law enforcement to have them investigated to see if there was any hate crimes. This is where we're spending our time. You know what law enforcement said? We have a First Amendment in this country. Like, we would arrest people for a marquee sign. But this is where we're spending our time. And I think that translates back to what you said about, you know, Democrats not having their head on straight and worried about these other issues. Like, there's much bigger fish to fry. And so, I don't know if I connected any dots there, but it's wild out there, Gerardo.
Yeah, no. I think that's exactly right. And again, for those of you that are new to this podcast, I tend to lean more libertarian. I think government is necessary, but I think small and efficient government is the way. I am all for a comprehensive immigration plan that allows for productive people that want to be in this country legally and want to produce and provide culture and contribute and have upward mobility. I don't want the rapist and the killer and any of those people not being vetted. The system we have now disallows the good and allows the bad, because there is no real, everybody can't get a special skills visa like Melania, right? Like, that's just not the reality for most immigrants, right? So most people have no clear path other than waiting 5, 7, 10 years to hopefully maybe be let in. It should be more efficient than that. It should be with the technology we have, where like these cameras can follow you all day long. You're telling me we don't have a better vetting process to cut the timeline down, where we say, you want to work, you want to contribute, you get this amount of time to prove that up. You're going to pay the taxes. You're not going to take any of our social benefits. You know, you're not going to live here and just freeload. But if you can prove that you're productive and you're law abiding, then yes, you can get a temporary visa, and then that can turn into a permanent one. You don't have to be a scholar to map out a good immigration plan that, again, allows us to focus on removing the bad and keeping the bad out and in enforcing our borders. I'm all for that. But it has to cut both ways. We don't have either right now. Neither is happening. I mean, you could lie to yourself and tell yourself that ICE is making a difference, or that, you know, the deportations are up and that the border crossings are down. Those are band-aids. Like, those aren't real fixes to anything. And I think for too long in this country, we've gotten used to band-aids, where we don't really fix anything. We just diagnose a problem correctly and then completely mess up the implementation of the solution. So again, that's it. I'll get off of that. Let's get to the premium portion of the podcast, unless you got anything to add to that there, Nick.
I was just going to connect it to the labor market. Like, what's the Dirty Jobs guy's name? I forget his name, but there's a video going around of him recently on a podcast where he was talking about these electricians in the Midwest making, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year because of the data center build out, and we can't find enough skilled labor, whether it's electricians or plumbers or whatever it is. And, you know, there's a case to be made, setting aside the college versus trade school debate, but there's a case to be made that, you know, the U.S. should be investing in, you know, some of these trade programs and getting people funding to learn these skills, which are costing so much for the economy, especially if we want to do this data center build out. And then that spills over to the metal sector as well, which you and I talked about recently. I told you there was a really good article in Reuters a month or two ago about how many universities in China have specialties in mining and metallurgy and rare earth separation. And here, like, we have only a dozen or so like mine schools left in the country. And I think there was a new article this week in Bloomberg, which is why it's fresh in my mind, about this like 86-year-old engineer that's basically come out of retirement to consult with Energy Fuels. Now that we start talking about companies, because like nobody else has the expertise. And so like we're starting to course correct that. There was mention of University of Wyoming in there, Virginia Tech, and I think Penn State, you know, starting these programs about metallurgy. And it was an illuminating article. I'll post a link to it when we publish the recap of this podcast. But just saying that, basically folks are like headhunting, and it's just going back and forth, whether it's the electricians, they're like hiring them away from companies, or if it's rare earth companies, like the Bloomberg article was citing, and I didn't know this, like, there was a court case, like the company USA Rare Earths was trying to steal, like basically like team of metallurgists and PhDs or whatever from MP Materials, I believe it was. Correct. And anyway, it was a really good article. I'll post a link to it. So, and we haven't invested in that stuff, like you were saying, like we've been content to kick the can, is essentially what you were just saying. And we've done that in all sorts of stuff that's now coming back to bite us. But as we correct it, as long as we continue to do so, we'll present opportunities, not just for jobs in the trades, but, you know, for some of these companies as well, especially in the critical metals and base metal sector. So you want to talk about companies? You want to talk about opportunities? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's get to it. And again, I do want to give kudos to this administration on the critical metal side. They have shown a bright light on the absolute need to advance a critical metals supply chain that's independent of China, that includes the talent, the labor pool, and hopefully, you know, that can continue and be expedited and expanded, because on that front, they've been great. We could have minor disagreements about, you know, drilling in national parks and all of that. But on the actual expediting of permitting and emphasizing the need for independent critical metal supply chains, they've done well on that aspect of it. So kudos on that front. Let's get to the premium portion of the podcast. I am Gerardo Del Real, along with Mr. Nick Hodge. This was 372nd episode of our weekly therapy session called Investing in Bizarro World. Folks, I know it's the summertime. I know it's slow. Things are on the down end of things. This time next year, by the end of this year, we'll be looking back laughing at the prices right now. Enjoy the summer. Get outside. Enjoy the heat. Enjoy the rest of it. And we'll see you next week, folks.
Enjoy the World Cup final. See you next week.
Cheers.